Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, the military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veterans Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now, here's Tom Lyons.
Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we'll meet with the Minnesota National Guard's 133rd Airlift Wing, and we'll learn about a veteran service organization dedicated to our combat wounded veterans. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
Happy 377th birthday to the National Guard. The National Guard traces its origins to a direct declaration on December 13, 1636. That day, the Massachusetts General Court in Salem established that all able-bodied men between the ages of 16 and 60 were required to join the militia. Simply stated, citizen soldiers who mustered for military training could be and would be called upon to fight when needed. This December 13th, we celebrate the 377th birthday of the National Guard. Not only do our National Guardsmen respond to state emergencies, they have a long history of activation ranging from the Revolutionary War to our current mission in Afghanistan. Yet while the Guard has turned into a worldwide military force, we still retain the core characteristics that brought us into being. The Guard is an invisible force among you in the community. We could be sitting in the office next to you, the mechanic fixing your car. Maybe we are the farmer in a distant field, or a police officer directing traffic. The Minnesota National Guard is made up of more than 13,000 Air and Army National Guard members. On behalf of these fine service members, it's an honor to serve our state and nation and to be part of a 377-year tradition.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me now is Brigadier General Greg Hasse, who is the former commander of the 133rd Airlift Wing of the Minnesota National Guard. General, I wanted to say Colonel again. You got promoted. General Hasse, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure to be here. It's not that far removed from being a colonel, so I answer to either one yet appropriately.
Sir, I see the stars and will salute them.
Thank you.
General, can you tell our audience a little bit about your military career and the years that you spent as a commander of the 133rd?
Yes. I'm very fortunate to have got the opportunity to serve in such a great capacity. And I can't help but reflect back to, starting this career in the Cold War and flying through the Berlin Corridor and some of that neat, exciting times of that, but also seeing the wall come down and then working our way through the Balkans and in the 90s. And then, of course, when Shield and Storm in the early 90s and finally into 9/11 and all the work and great work that the Guard has done since then. So in our deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq and being the commander of a wing during wartime or conflict is pretty special in retrospect. During the time, it was fairly stressful. But in retrospect, it was a lot of fun. It was fun seeing the kids grow, seeing them appreciate what service is, and that undying ability just to step forward at a moment's notice and go serve. And in fact, I would think of even Katrina and some of the local stuff that we did. I almost literally had to hold people back from driving down there to try to help folks out. And so that's the kind of, folks that we have that just are there to help, people when they are in need. So it's fun. That was probably my most precious memories, are seeing those kids grow as well as myself grow, into somebody that really understands service and what a special opportunity that really is.
Sir, you must have had a busy 7 years. You're right in the heart of all the deployments. Any idea how many deployments during your command of the 133rd?
Not the exact number. I knew we started to track the deployments by the number of active duty days that we had accomplished. And through since 9/11, I think we just are right at 1 million days. So that's a pretty good effort when you spread that over 1,200 people. That's a lot of days that they put forward. Yeah. The average, you take 120 days is the average AEF period, and many of our airmen were doing that upwards of 70% of the wing during those war years. So that's a big commitment, and we know it's a big commitment from our employers as well, and we really leaned on them heavily during those years to make sure that they knew we appreciated what they were doing and the sacrifices they were making as well. Because when you jerk somebody out of the workplace and you say, hey, you're going to be gone for half the year, that's a pretty big commitment from an employer standpoint. So we're very appreciative of that.
And despite all those deployments, your airmen kept re-enlisting and kept coming back for more, didn't they?
They did, yeah. Our, you know, retention rates were maintained in the mid-90s. So once we got them, they certainly wanted to stay. And there was no shortage. We were up, you know, we had to actually pull back. We were up to 110% manned for a while, and we tried to hit the sweet spot there, about 104 to 105%. And so that's kind of where we tried to level off and stay there. 110% is almost too much. I mean, that's too many people to handle with the days and the rank that is available. But 105% is pretty good. Yeah, they kept coming. It was great. It's, I think, pretty much a big tribute to Minnesota and the quality of people that we have through in and throughout, people that want to serve and understand how precious that is.
General, in our next segment, we're going to talk to the current commander of the 133rd Aerial Wing, Colonel Jim Johnson. Did you have any special advice you gave him to change the command?
Jimmy and I have been friends for a lot of years. I wanted to use the term that my predecessor, General Casalter, had used, and but I held back from that. It was something to the effect, I'm giving you a good wing, so don't screw it up. But, you know, Jimmy's a great guy, and he'll do wonderful things with that wing. And it was time. It was time for a change and a change of a new leader there, and I couldn't have thought of a better man to take that role over. So we had the, you know, fortunate opportunity to talk for, oh, gosh, a good 2 to 3 months. So hopefully I relayed to him some of the things that I'd learned. You know, one of the probably hardest things to do, I would say, is to step up onto the balcony. Because you get so drawn down and mired into the everyday workings of the wing, the operational part of it, you know, the support part of it, you know, torn between, you know, different masters constantly. How do you step up on the balcony and really take a good strategic look on occasion to make sure you're ahead of the wing and you're actually leading them? You're not just part of them moving along, right? And so I think that's probably the hardest part, is sometimes just to be able to pull back from the fray and step above and go, hey, you know, to be successful here, we need to re-look at this, or we need to redo this and rethink some different things about the way we approach and do our business here.
Good advice, sir. We're speaking with Brigadier General Greg Hasse on Minnesota Military Radio. General, I believe that was last August that the change of command?
It was, yeah. Just my wife wrote the Christmas card, so she was kind of joking. It was, let's see, we retired him. We promoted him, and we gave him a new job in a 3-day period. So that was a pretty hectic time, but a pretty special time, too. So, yeah, we did the promotion on one day and family day the next, and then the retirement or the change of command, and then off to a new job I went on Monday. So it was pretty quick.
And, sir, that's what we're going to talk about now, is your promotion and your new job. What are you doing?
Yeah, it's I kind of gave myself almost 4 months to try to learn this business, so I'm kind of at the end of my 4-month period here. So hopefully I can speak somewhat legitimately as to what our true work is over there. So I'm not flying anymore. It's not like running a wing, but it's the director and the joint staff over in European Command, and the director of the Joint Interagency Counter Trafficking Center, and that's a mouthful. But in essence, what we do is we always work on request and in support of U.S. and partner nation law enforcement. And so anything to do with counter-narcotics, counter-threat finance, combating terrorism, anything illicit that we can touch, generally we work in a support role and bring those unique qualities and that unique skill set that the military might have to support our partner nations over there.
Sir, would I be correct in assuming that when you were in command of the 133rd here in Minnesota, you worked with a lot of the local agencies and in those things, and now you're doing the same thing, only on a grander basis over in Europe?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of transferables there. And of course, when you enter into something new, you look for something that you know. And the thing that I knew that helped me move forward in this job was that, you know, as the wing commander in an Air National Guard unit, you work very closely with our first responders, our local law enforcement. You know, if it's the floods in western Minnesota or the fires in the Boundary Waters or the 35W bridge collapse, we were generally there in some capacity. And so I found that to be very comparable to what I'm doing over there. So if there's something that's going on in the illicit world, we're there to support and help our partner nations, and especially in the law enforcement category. So, yeah, a lot of transferables in that regard. So I kind of understand how that relationship should work, which is very helpful because, you know, most of the world revolves around expectations and relationships, right?
Yes, sir. So now I assume you're spending a lot of time in Europe and you're meeting your counterparts and you're developing new relationships. And when there's an emergency and they need some help, you know the people and you've got the contacts and you know who to call and they know who to call too.
Yeah. And not, you know, not so much, you know, for crises like that, but we will deal with the everyday of counter narcotics and counter threat finance. But yeah, it's very important to know that, you know, like the Turkish National Police and some of the different folks that we support, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, I was really just gone 25 of the last 30 days. And so I get a break now. I'm home for a month, which is nice over the holidays. But yeah, we had a conference in London too for Borderpol, Border Police. So a lot of talk on, you know, the Schengen zone and, you know, how they've cleared the borders up. But when you make the borders easy for everybody to transit, then everything else can transit those borders quite easily. And a lot of that stuff, unfortunately, isn't legal. And so, you know, we just kind of work with those partner nations and whatever we can do to help them, if it's just training, perhaps something as simple as that. You know, what does the U.S. do as far as customs and border protection? And, you know, how do we work our interstate boundaries? You know, some interesting thoughts are with the legalization of marijuana in Colorado and Washington, some of the border states there are a little nervous because some of that product is leaving Colorado.
Sure.
And for good reason, because you get more for it outside Colorado than you do inside Colorado. And so, yeah, there's some parallels that we can make here in the U.S. to how perhaps we can help them over there and support their needs.
General, we've just got about a minute left, but can I assume that you've retired from your full-time job, probably hung up your wings, you're not flying a 130 anymore, and now you're part-time in this position as Director, U.S. European Command's Joint Interagency Counter-Trafficking Center. That is a mouthful,
sir. It is, yeah. I compared this again to almost like when I first started, and we call them guard bums or totally available personnel, and that's kind of what I'm doing. It's about half-time. It's probably 150 days a year that I'm working over there between telecommuting here and then actually physically being over in Europe. So it's kind of fun. I think my wife likes it now. She's kind of getting used to it because I can pick up a lot of the stray ends at home, i.e. as far as the laundry and some of the cooking and shopping, and so it's kind of fun.
Get after that to-do list, sir.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I chipped away at a better part of it already, so that's been nice. It's fun. It's fun to kind of relax for a little bit, but I do feel that I'll have to go and do something else here just to kind of compensate for that free time I'll have.
General, it looks like you've had a great career and a good position now, Brigadier General. What would you tell the young people listening today if they're thinking about a career in the Minnesota National Guard or in the military?
You know, for me, it was a very, very special experience coming from a very small town in North Dakota and being able to do some of the things that I perhaps only dreamed about, but to fly airplanes, to serve people, there is nothing more special. So, you know, if there's a little piece of your heart that's calling and it's calling in the name of duty or in the name of service, follow that. Follow your heart. Let it lead you into something better.
General, it's good to see you again, and thank you for joining us today on Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you, Tom.
This is Brigadier General Greg Hasse. When we come back, we're going to meet the new commander of the 133rd Airlift Wing of the Minnesota National Guard, Colonel Jim Johnson. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We're being joined in this segment by Colonel James Johnson from the Minnesota National Guard. He's the commander of the 133rd Airlift Wing. Colonel Johnson, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me today.
Colonel, can you tell us a little bit about your military career, how long you've been in the military? I understand you started back in the University of Minnesota at ROTC.
Yeah, that's right. Back in 1982, I started an ROTC program out there at the U of M in Minneapolis, and I graduated in 86, and I was fortunate enough to get a pilot training slot and went on to fly with the active duty Air Force for about 7 years, and then transitioned back here to Minnesota with the Air National Guard after that point.
Colonel, was being a pilot something that you dreamed of doing as a young man?
Well, contrary to a lot of people, it wasn't something like from, you know, 4 years old or something that I had, you know, focused on entirely, but I had thought about it quite a bit throughout the years, and it wasn't really until I got into the ROTC program that I found out about some of the flying opportunities there. And so it really really flourished during my time at the U in Minneapolis.
And Colonel, you joined the 133rd Airlift Wing in 1994?
Yes, following the active duty stint that I had, I was fortunate. My wife and I were both from the Twin Cities, and we moved back to Minnesota, and luckily they had some openings during that time, and I was fortunate enough to get picked up by the 133rd.
Sir, you must have logged a few hours in a C-130.
Yeah, some people keep track of it a little closer than others, but it's probably somewhere between about 4,000 and 5,000 hours in that airplane, and I have quite a bit of aviation experience in other aircraft as well.
And, sir, I understand you served in quite a few positions at the 133rd before becoming commander.
Yes, kind of moved around. One might say I wasn't able to hold a job. The optimist might say, well, it was a good experience. Luckily, I was selected for several promotion opportunities and broadening opportunities as well. So I started out in the airlift squadron and was an air crew member and worked in a training department there. And then I was lucky enough to be selected as a commander in the aircraft maintenance squadron and worked my way up through the maintenance organization up to the group commander. Following that, I was selected to be the vice wing commander, and so that really helped a lot. Allowed me to work with the wing staff and become a lot more broadened with some of the support functions on the base as well. And then following a fairly extensive deployment after that, I moved back into the operations realm and was most recently the operations group commander for a couple of years prior to being selected as the wing commander this summer.
And, Colonel, as the wing commander of the 133rd Airlift Wing at the Minnesota Air National Guard, can you tell us what is, you have a combined federal and state mission. Can you tell us a little bit about the mission of the 133rd?
Right. Yeah, we're trained. We use a state task and training to do our daily events, and we're certainly able to respond to community and state events on a moment's notice, and so our day-to-day boss would technically be the governor of Minnesota, and then we are obviously prepared, and anytime we deploy overseas or there's national or federal tasking, then of course we have the president as our boss, so we do have that dual role, which is unique to the Guard, the dual state and federal role.
And, sir, how many airmen and how many aircraft do we have in the 133rd?
We have approximately 1,200 airmen, and we have eight C-130 H-3 aircraft at base.
We're speaking with Colonel Jim Johnson, the commander of the 133rd Airlift Wing of the Minnesota Air National Guard, on Minnesota Military Radio. Colonel, the 133rd, I understand, can you tell us how the deployments have worked over the last few years? They go out in smaller groups than the Army National Guard, don't they?
Right. We have a little different construct than the Army. We go into smaller deployment pieces, and we usually go in anywhere from groups of, you know, one or two to groups of 70 or 80. And we unite in a forward location with hundreds of other organizations, and thus we our footprint, once we're deployed, you know, can be in the thousands, but we make up a small portion of that. But fortunately, all of our training within the Air National Guard and the Air Force is standardized, so it is plug and play. We can take a piece of our unit and match up with another unit that we've never seen before, and it's basically a seamless integration to be able to perform the missions in a deployed location.
So, Colonel, this holiday season, how many airmen do we have deployed?
We're under 40 this year. We have a couple coming back right before Christmas, we're hoping, and so that's why I'm not exactly sure if it's going to be 38 or 37, but that's one of the lower numbers we've had this year, in recent years, but it's still significant, especially for those families involved in them. And just moments ago, I was talking to one of our commanders that's deployed right now that won't be home for Christmas, and so it's a sober reminder that there are going to be some members that aren't around. But fortunately, over 1,150 of our 1,200 airmen will be home for the holidays this year.
And Colonel, are there some important things that you're looking forward to as being the commander of the 133rd?
Well, I certainly am looking forward to working with the nearly 1,200 airmen that have shown to be extremely dedicated, professional, and eager to learn. I know that they'll continue to work hard and become experts in their field. And as we mentioned earlier, be ready and able to meet the needs of our community, state, and nation at a moment's notice. It's truly an honor to be trusted with this responsibility and given the opportunity to have such a significant role in this effort. So I'm truly honored for that and looking forward to that in the future.
Colonel, I understand there's kind of an important anniversary coming up.
Yes, we are approaching 100 years as the Air National Guard. Our unit was the first federally recognized Air National Guard unit in the nation, and we are approaching that. We're a few years away. We just celebrated our 90th 2 years ago, and so we are a few years from that, but it looks like it's going to be a great situation, and we truly had a storied history that had began, you know, with the pioneers in aviation, as I mentioned, in the early 20s, and their dedicated, you know, service to the communities, and we're all really proud of that history, and the sense of service definitely lives with our unit yet today, and I think this anniversary is going to help, you know, connect our current Guard, you know, family members with our predecessors at we would probably term our senior Guard family members, and hopefully it'll, you know, provide a avenue or a catalyst for this service-oriented family to flourish long into the future. So really looking forward to the preparation efforts as that approaches.
Sir, we've just got about a minute left. I would imagine that there's not a single airman in the 133rd that isn't aware that they're going to be deployed. But I'm sure you're also still looking for a few good men and women.
Right. We have one of the highest retention rates in the nation, but even that being said, approximately, if you assume a 20-year career, probably 5% or more of our airmen are turning out over every year. So we continually are looking for the best and brightest and welcome anybody who's interested to contact our recruiters and see if there's a good fit for them out here at the 133rd.
Colonel, good luck with your command, and thank you for taking time to visit with us today on Minnesota Military Radio.
Oh, I appreciate that. You're very welcome, Tom, and thanks for having us today.
Thank you, sir. That was Colonel Jim Johnson, commander of the 133rd Airlift Wing for the Minnesota National Guard on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. In a minute, we'll learn about a veteran service organization dedicated to our combat wounded veterans. Please stay with us.
Hi, this is Bill Popp of the Minnesota Military Family Foundation. An Army squad is made up of 8 soldiers, and when the squad is on patrol, each soldier is dependent on each other for safety. When a soldier is distracted because of a financial crisis with the family back home, that puts every soldier on the squad at risk. The Minnesota Military Family Foundation helps turn a bad situation into a positive one. The foundation provides financial support during a financial crisis at home. This helps re-energize the soldier. The soldier feels the financial burden lifted and has feelings of pride because of the support from the community at home. When the soldier is no longer focused on the financial crisis at home, the soldier is able to stay engaged in the mission and do his duty to protect other soldiers in the squad. When we help one soldier, we're helping all soldiers. When we help one military family, we're helping all military families. If you're in a position to help, please donate. Go to MinnesotaMilitaryFamilyFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to meet a fellow Vietnam veteran, and we're going to learn about a veteran service organization dedicated to our combat wounded veterans. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shalito.
In November, our St. Paul Claims and Outreach team held a grand reopening to celebrate a new and improved claims office. The new office suites provide staff with improved workflow space, advanced conferencing capability, and private spaces which allow veterans to meet with representatives. The MDVA Claims Office, located in St. Paul and Fargo, are responsible for more than $1 billion in compensation and pension payments for Minnesota veterans and their survivors. Last year, the St. Paul office submitted over 17,000 claims on behalf of veterans and their families. Our claims staff also participates in hundreds of community events annually around Minnesota to reach out to veterans and educate them about the benefits they have earned. For more information about the Minnesota Department of Veterans Claims Affairs and Outreach Division, visit MinnesotaVeteran.org.
Thank you, Commissioner Shalito. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me now is the State Adjutant of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, Department of Minnesota, Mr. Richard Jenkins. Mr. Jenkins, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you very much.
You're also a fellow Vietnam veteran.
Yes, I am.
And I think you served a few years before I did, so
yes.
If I'm old, you're older, so we'll have to live with that. Could you tell me, where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Kansas City, Kansas, and it was pretty much of the urban area. And at the same time, I graduated from the only black high school in Kansas City, Kansas, called Sumner High School in 1961.
And back in those days, we had a thing called the draft, didn't we?
That's correct. Very much. And it was always a thought in my mind, because after graduating in 1961, I used to listen to the news and the radio, and a number of the advisors were over in Vietnam. And so I just knew it would only be a matter of time that perhaps I would be drafted, even though I wasn't excited about it.
And you got married about somewhere in there, too, didn't you?
After about 2 years staying in, after my graduation, I moved to moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, and my uncle resided here. And I asked him if I could stay here because I wanted something better than what was offered to people of color in Kansas City, Kansas. And so I got me a job at the car wash on the corner of Snelling and University. And I was able to move from that job to a job in the Montgomery Ward Merchandise Center. And I kept that job until I was drafted.
And somewhere in there, you found a nice young lady.
I found a nice young lady. We've been married for 49 and a half years. Her name is Cecilia Jenkins. And after being in combat in Vietnam, they call her Saint Cecilia, because she said, "Lord, hurry up and change him. He's on my last nerve."
And you're smiling, so you must approve of that.
Yes, I do.
Now, did you ever imagine that you were working and you were married, and did you ever imagine you were going to still get caught by the draft?
Let's put it this way. Kennedy had implemented a law that says that if you're married, you don't have to go. And so my wife and I were engaged at the time, and it was initiated from me, and we got married, and lo and behold, Uncle Sam said, "We still need you."
So it didn't do you any good.
It didn't do me any good at all.
Richard, can you share with our listeners, what was the mood in the United States at that time? There were a lot of things going on.
Yes, the mood in the United States. I grew up in a segregated community in the urban area in Kansas City, Kansas. I went to all black schools from the kindergarten to the 12th grade and graduated from the only black high school in Kansas City, Kansas. So I was exposed to many of the racism and stuff. My dad was a country preacher, and I remember clearly when I was before I had left Kansas City that I could only attend certain restaurants. If I wanted to go to a movie, I had to sit upstairs. I was always separated. You are always cognizant of where you could go and where you could not go. And so when I asked my uncle if I could come up here, I saw all these Caucasians, and I said, "Man, there's hardly no black people here."
Well, that may be.
Well, yes, but at the same time, Vietnam and the schooling that I have achieved here has changed me from the crown of my head to the soles of my feet. I have many friends, both people of color as well as Caucasians, who have helped me and been an inspiration to me. So it's changed me all around.
We're speaking with Richard Jenkins, the state adjutant for the Military Order of the Purple Heart and a fellow Vietnam veteran, on Minnesota Military Radio. So, Richard, in those days, about the time you were drafted, we had some racial problems going on. There were anti-war riots. There were draft dodgers. There were hippies and flower children. It was a mess, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. The Students for Democratic Society. I was a student of the college out there at the University of Minnesota. And all the radical elements that you could even imagine. And at the height, at the same time, it was the height of the civil rights struggle, where Martin Luther King and other people were speaking out that we should be able to gain better jobs and be able to be a part of society instead of just being in the background at all times.
Richard, I want to talk about your service now. You went to basic training, and I'd like to know the job you were trained for, and then did you go immediately to Vietnam?
No, I didn't. I went to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri for my basic training, 6 weeks of basic training. And then from there, instead of coming home to go to my second series of training, they sent me directly to Fort Polk, Louisiana, in an advanced infantry training. That was the first time I thought about going AWOL because my wife and I were married at that time. However, my mother was able to give me some money where my wife could come home in Kansas City, Kansas, where we stayed, and we were able to take a little honeymoon, about 3 days, and I was back on the bus en route to Fort Polk, Louisiana, which is red clay and hot as everything.
And infantry training means automatic, you're going to get to Vietnam.
That's right. But it didn't happen that way. I stayed there in advanced infantry training, and then I was drafted for 2 years, but they sent me to Fort Carson, Colorado. And we used to do a lot of bivouac training in the mountains. And my wife used to tell me, oh, they're beautiful mountains. I said, but they're not so beautiful when you're climbing all the time.
It's good training, though.
Yeah, it was.
Well, when did you get to Vietnam?
I went to Vietnam with 7 months left to go into service. I got orders prior to that, leaving Fort Carson, Colorado. I was a stockade guard carrying a double pump shotgun, guarding prisoners who had been mischievous in some way or another. And with 7 months left to go, I had orders cut for me to report to Fort Riley, Kansas, in preparation for Vietnam. And so we went through something like 2 or 3 weeks of training of that, and then I was loaded on an aircraft carrier and sent to San Francisco to be processed out. And then from San Francisco to be processed out, instead of flying to Vietnam on plane, I was loaded on a ship, which ran into a hurricane. And everybody was sick as everything. And I was telling them, it's all in your mind. And everybody was puking, and I ended up doing the same thing.
You had quite a trip.
Yeah.
So what year and month did you arrive in Vietnam?
I arrived in Vietnam around September the 26th, and lo and behold, I think it was Cameron Bay that we were dislodged, and we traveled on 5-ton diesel trucks towards Phuc Vinh, and as a result, we found out that we were being attacked by Kong because we didn't have no weapons at all. So we were nothing but clay pigeons.
You were off to a good start. Hurricane and being attacked without weapons.
It was just hunky-dory.
And you were assigned to the Big Red One.
The Big Red One, 1st Army Division.
And your duty was?
My duty was I was delegated as the point man. I was in Alpha Company of the 1st Battalion 26th Infantry. And they told me point blank, you're going to be point man. Many people of color were put in that position. So coming from a segregated community and put in that particular position really caused great fear and anticipation. Why was I chosen? Because I did everything what they asked me to do, but why point man? Because the point man was expendable.
And it was pretty much automatic. You were going to earn a Purple Heart, wasn't it?
I guess you could say that.
And you did.
I did, yes.
What happened that day? You were on point on a patrol?
Yes. We've been on many search and destroy missions, some of them were very close. A number of men were killed. during that 7 months. Being in that point position caused me to have despair. I had to be super sensitive about what I was looking at and be aware of trip wires, be aware of panji pits, be aware of snipers, because I was always in the front. There were people on my right flank and left flank, but I was always in the front. And the point man was expendable. He was the one to catch a sniper's bullet. He was the one to step on a booby trap. He was the one that will have first contact. And so I thought about this at all times. I thought about death 24/7. And I had never been in that position. Many people look at the John Wayne movie and Audie Murphy movie, but it's different when you're in combat, because you can't make too many friends, because you don't know who's going to live and who's going to die.
Richard, we have to take a short break. When I come back, I want to talk a little more about how you were wounded, and then we have to tell our folks, our listeners, about the Military Order of the Purple Heart. We're speaking with Richard Jenkins, a Vietnam veteran and the state adjutant of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been joined by Richard Jenkins, a fellow Vietnam veteran and the state adjutant of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, Department of Minnesota. Richard, when we went to break, we were talking about the fact that you were in Vietnam, assigned to the Big Red One, point man on the patrols, and you were out watching for all of the things that could go wrong, and there were plenty of them.
That's correct.
But then one day you had to check out a tunnel.
That's correct. My commanding the commanders, who was the captain, Captain Fisher, asked me, would I be willing to fire my grenade launcher into this tunnel, and I did. And we found out that the tunnel had a booby trap that sent shrapnel to my left thigh, extremely hot, and it was embedded in my left thigh. And as a result, I was the first one wounded in my company. And I received a minor operation there in the field, and then from there I was flown by helicopter to Saigon. I stayed in the hospital for about 7 or 8 days, and I thought I was going to come home, but they said, no, you're going to go back to the barracks, and you're going to rest for 3 days, and you'll be right back on the search and destroy mission.
So we're back out on point again.
Back on point again.
So that was when you earned your Purple Heart.
Yes, yes.
And today, you're the state adjutant for the Military Order of the Purple Heart here in Minnesota.
That's correct. And we have roughly about 1,400 men and women who are recipients of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, from World War II to Korean conflict to Afghanistan and Iraqi veterans, you name it.
And how many organizations within Minnesota of the Purple Heart?
There are approximately, we have the DAV, the VFW, the Purple Heart, the...
There's nine federally chartered veteran service organizations.
Yes, yes.
But within your Purple Heart memberships, do they have like little posts, or are they all one group?
Yeah, they have the little posts, and at the same time, those with the Purple Heart, it stands for blood spilled in battle, and we had spilled our blood in battle in behalf of protecting the United States.
And what's the mission of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, Department of Minnesota?
The mission of the Military Order of the Purple Heart is to give recognition for those who have received the Purple Heart, either posthumously or those who are actually wounded in action. It wasn't until to the year 2000 that I realized that there was a Military Order of the Purple Heart. I had no idea that this was such an organization, but it's a very prestigious organization, and at the same time, it's the oldest medal in the nation.
And how far back does that medal go?
I think it goes back to George Washington, who had the Legion of Merit, who had first thought about awarding the veterans who had spilled blood in battle and who had protected this country. And General MacArthur is the one that made it official. And I think it is in 1934 where it was officially made a medal of the Military Order Purple Heart, combat wounded.
Richard, last year we had your former Commander Brown on, and he told us that the creed of the Military Order of the Purple Heart was, don't forget that we have an extra heart. So we should share that with another veteran.
Okay. I agree with that.
That sounds like what you're doing?
Yes, yes. One of the things at the Purple Heart is that we recognize not only those who have received the Purple Heart, but we recognize veterans who are in need of relationship. We visit them in the nursing homes and in the veterans' homes. We make ourselves available, especially during Christmas time and special times where we recognize them and their families for what they have done. And so we make ourselves available to assist them in any way we can, especially those who are Purple Heart recipients, because they have spent most of their time in helping other people. And this is what we want to do.
We're speaking with Richard Jenkins, State Adjutant of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, Department of Minnesota, on Minnesota Military Radio. Richard, can you tell us about the National Service Officers in Minnesota and what they do?
Yes, the National Service Officer, in which I was one in the year 2001, is to help file claims for those who have been disabled or who have suffered a setback in their medication, whatever the case may be, but we are to file claims on their behalf. And when you have it on your DD-214, you can get service much more quicker than just a regular disability.
So you help speed up those claims?
Yes, we do.
And in Minnesota, we have both men and women that are recipients of the Purple Heart.
That's right. In fact, I made a special appeal to women who are recipients of the Purple Heart. To this day, no one has responded, but I have made contact with Wendy Buckingham, who is an officer, national officer in the military of the Purple Heart, to appeal to women that they will be respected and honored here.
And Richard, last question. Where can our listeners go for more information?
You can contact me at 651-227-4456. And my name is Richard Jenkins, the department adjutant, to recognize. And I have the ability to go on the national site to see if they are recipients of the Purple Heart case.
And we'll have a link to your contact information on Facebook under Minnesota Military Radio.
Yes.
Richard, I'd like to thank you for joining us today and telling us about your service in Vietnam and your service to our country and all the things you're still doing to help fellow veterans.
Thank you very much, sir.
That was Richard Jenkins, a state adjutant, the Military Order of the Purple Heart on Minnesota Military Radio. We're just about out of time. If you have a mailbag question or a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to address, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com and click on Contact Us to send us a note. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Brigadier General Greg Hasse, Colonel Jim Johnson, Richard Jenkins, Commissioner Larry Shelido over the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we bring our Veterans Service organizations together for a special holiday show. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to Minnesota Military Radio with Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition firm. This has been a production of Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Podcasts of the show are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.